and the floor was lightly scented with ammonia. The hairdressers were vibrant, with colorful hair and face piercings. They had names like Celeste, Luna, and Sky. I flipped through a booklet with different hairstyles, showing Mama cuts I thought she might like. "Look at her bangs," I said, folding the page over for Mama to see.
"Those are nice, Hita. You guys are also getting haircuts."
"Here?" Harrison looked up from his seat, a surprised expression on his face.
"Yep. Don't need to worry about picking out anything new. I told the ladies what to do."
My hair had recently grown extra long with the help of Grandma Estrella's tea. Mama normally took me to Cost Cutters for a trim, but last time, we were refused service. No one gave a reason why, but I knew it must have been lice. When a woman called my name, I jumped out of my seat and I stuck out my tongue to Harrison. He ignored me, scratching his head. Then another lady called his name. They brought us to a row of black spinning chairs, seating us side by side. My hairdresser snapped peppermint gum in her mouth. She had glitter across her eyelids, and her teeth were the whitest and biggest I had ever seen, like those white ladies in Grandma Estrella's stories. After she parted my hair with a black comb, she pointed beside me to Harrison, draped in a purple cape.
"Are you guys twins?" she asked.
"What do they call that, paternal?"
"No," said the lady, cutting Harrison's hair. "It's fraternal."
"That's it," my hairdresser said. "You sure do look about the same age."
Harrison giggled.
"I wish we were twins. That'd be cool."
"He's just my half-brother," I said. The hairdressers shared a knowing look, and I glanced away, toward the front windows. Outside, seagulls dived between street lamps. The sun was going down and the whole neighborhood was a shadowy pink. A family carrying pizza boxes walked together through the parking lot. It was a mom, a dad, and three little boys. The mom was laughing, pointing at her husband, who had grabbed a shopping cart and was riding the back like a scooter. His sons tried copying him. They wobbled everywhere, and the mom seemed worried. For just a second, I felt jealous of that family, their happiness and togetherness. Maybe if I had always known Harrison, we could have been friends. But instead, he reminded me of Daddy, the only person who had ever left me. The family then walked out of sight, and I looked back at the mirror. That's when I burst into tears. My long hair was gone, gathered across the floor like piles of dust. The hairdresser kept asking what was wrong, but all I could do was clutch my short hair, wetter in the front, from all my tears.
"Don't cry, Clarissa," I heard Harrison say. He was whimpering quietly. His head had been shaved completely bald.
I stood up then and looked for Mama. She was behind us at another station, her expression downturned and sorrowful. Her long black hair had been trimmed into a spiky undercut with short bangs. When her eyes met mine, she mouthed something. Maybe sorry. On our way out, Mama handed the receptionist a check, and one of the women tried selling her an anti-dandruff shampoo.
"You know, the kids both have it pretty bad," the woman insisted. "This will help for sure."
Mama shook her head, her short hair stationary against her scalp.
"Thanks, but we'll try some home remedies first."
Mama was crying. Harrison and I heard her when we were fighting over whose turn it was for the only working Nintendo controller. At first, it sounded like the neighbor's dog yipping, but it grew louder and steadier. I threw down the controller, and Harrison followed me. Sitting on the toilet with the lid closed, her head in her hands, Mama was itching and pulling at her short hair, red bumps all over her scalp and neck. Snot and tears dripped down her face, over her lips, and onto the front of her white shirt.
I stood in the doorframe, afraid to go near her. I had only seen her like this one other time, when Daddy left for good.
"They won't go away,"
she sobbed into her hands, gargling a bit. "What, Mama?"
"They just won't go away."
Harrison stood behind me, his dark eyes filling with tears that lingered above his bottom lashes. I could see the bathroom reflected in his eyes. Mama, alone, on the toilet with hair in her lap and across the floor. I wanted to scream at him to leave, to walk home, take a bus, find some way to get out of our lives. But instead, I just told him to watch Mama, while I ran to the kitchen and did what I was never supposed to do. I called Grandma Estrella. I told her what happened and had been happening for months. She screamed so loud that when she finished, I heard true silence in our townhouse kitchen. Dust sifted through shoots of sunlight. Water dripped from the chrome faucet. The phone's cord slowly rolled. Everything was calm until Mama's sobs bumped throughout the hallway, interrupting the dead air. She didn't hit me or scream at me when I told her Grandma Estrella was expecting us. Mama got up from the toilet lid, silent and red-faced, and walked to the car, as if she had been expecting this day from the beginning. When we arrived, Grandma Estrella stood on her porch, one hand over her eyes, scanning the yard with a watchful, hawk-like gaze. She wore a wavering purple skirt, the brick house like a castle behind her. Mama parked and got out of her car, flicking a cigarette into the road as she walked us to the porch.
"Look at your hair," Grandma Estrella said, "every one of you."
"It'll grow back,"
Mama said, quickly wiping tears from her face. Grandma Estrella grunted some. She stepped aside and motioned with both hands for us to follow her. Before she opened the front door, she reached out to Harrison's small hand and introduced herself as Mrs. Lopez. Harrison's dark eyes grew wide and seemed to fill with wonder. It was like he didn't have grandparents of his own, and I realized he probably didn't.
"All of you, upstairs."
We climbed the cherry oak staircase to the upstairs bathroom. The long white porcelain basin of the clawfoot tub rested in the otherwise dark room. It was cold, though the windows were cloaked in fog from a steaming metal pot on the floor, the pot Grandma Estrella normally used for menudo. She told all of us to get on our knees and drape our heads, face down, over the bathtub. The porcelain was chilly against my neck and arms. Grandma Estrella used to bathe me there when I was younger, working my knees and elbows with a washcloth and ivory soap. Once, I asked her why she needed to scrub so hard it hurt.
"Because we are not dirty people," she had said.
Later, when I asked Mama about it, she told me when Grandma Estrella was a little girl, her own teachers called her a dirty Mexican, and it never left her, the shame of dirt. Slowly, from behind me, I felt Grandma Estrella pour bitter water over my head, a liquid made from something called neem that had a thick, root-like stench. Grandma then combed my short hair, harsh and fast, pressing into my scalp. When she finished, she told me to stand up. "Mija, take this. Make sure to get the backside of their necks to the front side above their foreheads." She placed the heavy pot in my hands.
"But I don't think I can lift it."
"Don't be such a malcriada."
I braced myself, steadied my knees, and lifted the pot. My arms trembled as I poured the liquid over Harrison's small neck, seeing for the first time how incredibly scabbed and bitten he was.
"Does it hurt?" I asked.
"No, Clarissa," he said, muffled and soft. "I'm sorry they don't go away."
"Don't worry. This time it'll work."
As I finished pouring the water over Harrison's head, Grandma Estrella got on her knees and began rubbing his scalp with a white towel.
Don't get it down my back,
Mama said. She was tense against the tub, gripping the rim with white-knuckled hands. She kept looking back at me, squinting. That's when I noticed she was shaking, her legs and wrists trembling. Grandma Estrella had put down her white towel and was leaned over Mama. She reached out, letting her hands lightly rest on Mama's head, as if she was protecting her from the cold. Grandma Estrella whispered,
"That man and his choices are behind you now."
Mama said,
"I just wanted him to know he has a sister."
"And now he does, my baby. But none of this is your place."
She then danced her fingers over Mama's neck, motioning for me to begin pouring, wetting her skin along with Mama's. The next day, Mama put on a full face of makeup, ran mousse through her lice-free hair, and dropped Harrison off at his apartment on Grant Street. I waited outside in the car, looking up at the window I knew was his. I wanted to catch a glimpse of him, my only brother in the world. I watched until he finally appeared. With his skinny arms, he reached up and closed the blinds. It was the last time we dropped him off anywhere. Before Grandma Estrella died, she gave me a booklet of all her remedies. Inside, with an unsteady hand, she had drawn pictures of plants and, beneath them, their Spanish names, their scientific names, and just for me, their English names. I can cure head lice, stomach cramps, and bad breath with the right herbs. For the most part, I stick to over-the-counter remedies. They are cleaner and work faster and come in packages with childproof lids. But every once in a while, when I get a real bad headache and the aspirin isn't cutting it, I take slices of potatoes and hold them to my temples, hoping the bad will seep out of me. I see Harrison every now and then in the city at parties or shows. He's a bass player in a punk band called The Roaches. He's tall now, with a serious yet hopeful face. Sometimes I wonder if my dad looked like him as a young man, when both our mothers fell for his shit. Other times, I wonder if he's still giving everyone lice. But I doubt it. A couple months back, I was outside Lancer Lounge, and through the windows, I saw Harrison inside on the platform stage, bent over a microphone, a black cord rolled around his arm. When he stood up, we shared a look for a long time before I smiled, pointing to his blue mohawk. "Nice hair," I mouthed, and Harrison smiled back, as if he could hear me through the glass.
Julian Plaza. Read for you by Kyla Garcia. The lobby's hanging chalkboard announced all news. Grandchild births, bingo nights, funeral services. As part of our recent after-school routine, Cora and I regularly checked the chalkboard, which was updated by our father, Ramon, the maintenance man of over a decade at Julian Plaza Senior Home. On a Monday afternoon in early spring, Cora tilted forward in her velvet romper and matching red scrunchie. She squinted as she read,
"Mrs. Flores! I knew it!"
Cora pretended to choke herself with both hands, her eyes flickering white globes. She claimed all old people died in order of who was poorest, sickest, and loneliest.
"I liked that one. She didn't have crappy candy."
"Me too," I said. "She always had Skittles."
The elevator doors chimed open behind us, and our father marched out, carrying an orange bucket filled with tools. His shoulders were broad in his gray flannel, the sleeves rolled, bearing a faded eagle tattoo across his left forearm. With my light eyes and chestnut hair, I took after my father, whom my mother used to joke had the face of a conquistador, clover eyes, a long prominent nose, and a pointed Spanish chin from some long-lost Atencio ancestor. My father wore his auburn hair coiffed, and throughout the day, it rocked nicely in a calm wave. He only used fine-tooth black combs and breezy finesse shampoo.
"Rinse and repeat, my babies," he'd say. "That's how you get the smell to stick."
"Oh, Papa," Cora said. "Mrs. Flores kicked it?"
"Don't say that. Polite thing to say is passed away or..."
"Bites the dust? Keeled over?"
I giggled, but stopped when my father shot me a look.
"Don't encourage her, Alejandra. I need at least one civilized daughter."
He edged back on his sand-colored work boots, directing his gaze toward the large clock in the front office.
"Got a few more rounds."
He disappeared into the main hallway, the green carpet and pink walls swallowing his frame. Cora and I spent the afternoon in the basement rec room. No one was ever there, and it always had a smell like rocks. There were several dated exercise machines, boxes of Chinese checkers, a cable TV, and aspen tree wallpaper. Cora challenged me to race on the stationary bikes, and despite the pointlessness, I said okay. She settled into a slinking, cat-like stance, her long braided hair hanging over her left shoulder. Her sneakers were bright from thorough cleanings, but I could see the beginnings of a hole where an orange sock blinked. After several minutes of screeching gears and exaggerated breathing, she said,
"Do you think Papa loves one of us more than the other?"
She often asked questions like this, questions she'd answer herself. I kept pedaling. Cora slid off her bike. She walked to the recliner by the television and took a seat.
"It's pretty obvious he likes you better, for now. But I don't know about loves you better. That's much more complicated."
She clicked on the TV, searching for Nickelodeon.
"But you know what? He doesn't love either of us more than he loves Mama."
"You're supposed to love someone the most if they're sick," I said.
The previous December, my mother walked into the living room of our tiny 1920s home on Denver's east side. Cora and I were seated on the warped hardwood floor drawing mermaids with colored pencils. Outside on 26th Street, it was sleeting. Through the dusty front windows, grayish light came into the living room and illuminated my mother in a lime-colored towel. She walked toward us, her wet black hair dripping down her shoulders and neck. It looked as if she was melting, a woman made of wax. She kneeled onto the floor and asked Cora to feel her left breast, but my sister refused with a sour face. My mother then turned to me. Without asking, she guided my hand beneath the towel, over her satiny skin, her invisible body hairs prickly against my fingers.
"What does that feel like to you, Alejandra?"
"Where?" I asked.
"Here,"
she said, kneading my hand above her heart. Her substantial breast was warm and firm, and nested inside was a jagged pit.
"Baby girl?"
My mother pinched her lips, hardening her features.
"Please tell me what you feel."
"A rock, Mama. Beneath your skin."
Weeks later, my mother and father were at the kitchen table. Above them, a moth flew inside a frosted light fixture, casting its caged shadow over their faces. Cora and I had wiggled across the hallway rugs, positioning ourselves belly down above the staircase. We clung to the banister and peered through its splintered bars. My mother wore a blue nightdress, her plum-colored nipples visible through chiffon. The house felt musky and damp, and from somewhere in my gut, I knew this was the air of fear. My father kissed my mother's collarbones, held her slight wrists.
"We'll be fine, Nayeli," he said. "We can find a way to afford better treatments."
He stooped at my mother's side and appeared miraculously small, laying his head in her lap.
"Don't worry, mi querida."
My mother lifted her face into the light, her eyes focused somewhere near Cora and me. Cora ducked to the side, pulling me with her. As we stared at the rug, we heard our mother say, "They'll let you go if you start missing days.
There are other jobs, ones with better insurance."
"No," my mother said. "It's too risky to quit. I'll go to Cynthia's when it's time." Cora tugged on my left arm, edging us up from the floor. She had a severe, worried expression, and her dark eyes were cloudy.
"Why should Mama live there?" she whispered. "We can take care of her."
Miss Cynthia and her husband, a barber we called Uncle Rex, lived several blocks away in a house even older than ours. It had chipped teal paint and a long wooden wheelchair ramp that I like to imagine was a pirate ship's plank. That evening, after we left Julian Plaza, Cora and I stood on their porch covered in thick vines and dried leaves while my father knocked on the red door.
"Oh, my little Atencio dollies," Miss Cynthia said as she ushered us inside, a boy toddler on her hip.
Miss Cynthia was a Castillo, an old Spanish name that my father said was somewhere on our family tree, though I didn't see a resemblance. Her black eyes were seeds behind round, scratched glasses, and her hair was silver, braided in a bun at the nape of her neck. She was a thick-set woman, her breasts weighing into her waistline. She always wore a rooster print apron with lumpy pockets filled with pacifiers, and her sneakers were clunky and beige. Though she was old, Miss Cynthia was what my father called spry. She led us through the kitchen where cookies and baby food rested on the table. Across the checkered linoleum floor, we passed more toddlers playing with blocks and a plastic rocking horse. Miss Cynthia stepped over them and stopped at the back door, where my mother stayed.
"She's loopy today," she said to our father. "It's them new pills. They're no good."
The boy toddler on Miss Cynthia's hip stared at me. When I waved, he turned away. In the back room, before a three-paneled window, my mother sat in a used metal wheelchair, her head tilted lightly to the right, her wrists dangling over the armrests. She looked outside and appeared to watch the fruitless peach trees quiver in the yard. It was sunset, the sky gold and lavender. The room was built into the shape of a half moon with its own outside entrance, as if Uncle Rex had built onto the house as an afterthought, an extra way to charge rent. My mother's sick things were displayed beside her on an aluminum tray. An airbrushed painting of the Virgin Mary, a pink phone with a curly cord, a pig-colored bedpan, school portraits of Cora and me, and many orange pill bottles.
"Hi, Mama,"
I said, soft and low. My mother hummed and wetted her mouth with a sip of water.
"Alejandra the Alley Cat.
Can I show you something?" She bowed her head of loose hair. Sitting at her feet, I pulled the chapter book from my backpack, showing her illustrations of Marcus, a greenish horse riding a comet's tail.
"He can fly into other animals' dreams."
"Ah." My mother spun her index finger in circles around my temple.
"I can do that too."
"Are you a bruja, Mama?"
She smiled with her eyes. We sat around my mother like she was a tree, hooking onto her limbs, smoothing her scratchy Pendleton blankets. My father told stories of work, the new tenants, the old ones who had passed, and the renovations to the 8th floor deck. After a while, he was quiet and let his forehead rest against her crown. Before my mother was sick, he often slid his arms around her waist as she cooked dinner. He sniffed her curls and kissed her shoulders and earlobes. She used to giggle, shaking him off, saying, "Stop that, Ramon. The babies don't want to see that." My mother asked,
Where's Cora?
She was in the corner, sitting on the bed, studying a tray of orange prescription bottles when my father motioned for her. Cora hopped down. She walked sluggishly to our mother, giving her one kiss on the cheek. She eventually told her how much she missed her, speaking first quietly and then more urgently, telling our mother she wanted her back home.
I wear your t-shirts to bed. I like the Betty Boop one.
My mother nodded several times, her eyelids lowering like a weighted baby doll's. She was suddenly in and out of sleep, snoring and whistling like the vents at Julian Plaza. Cora grimaced and retreated to the bed. She stayed there for the rest of our visit. Before we left that evening, my father spoke to Uncle Rex. He was in the main room, arched over a fat man in a black barber's cape. Uncle Rex was giving him a shave. He looked up and said hello to us with a flick of his razor. My father paused between an open set of French doors.
I'll check that bathroom light now, Rex.
Uncle Rex nodded, smoothing a puff of shaving cream over the fat man's neck. My father then passed Miss Cynthia a handful of bills that she buried in her lumpy apron. For dinner, my father made goulash.
God damn, he said. It may be cheap, but babies, it's good.
He set the pot on the table, and Cora and I slid over each of our bowls. My father spooned heaving plops of noodles and ground beef into the blue plastic. He then grunted and took his seat, unfolding a white paper napkin over his grimy jeans before we prayed.
How is work today, Papa?
I asked.
Not great, he said. Mr. George Baker put in a call at noon for a dishwasher repair, but when I arrived, he didn't have a pulse. He was bent over the tub, naked as the day he came into this world, except his socks. He had on those.
How disgusting, Cora said, in between sips of water.
It is what it is, my father said. But that man had no one. Not a soul. It's a hard way to go, alone like that. But my God, was he hoarding. Watches, coins, electronics, all kinds of stuff.
Cora looked up from her goulash. Though she appeared to have something she wanted to say, she only glanced out the window, then looked back at her noodles, sliding her fork's prongs through three of them. I thought Mr. George Baker was one of the poorest men at Julian Plaza. He had moth-eaten suits, wilted fedoras, and no one ever visited him. Something Cora explained was a whole nother type of poor.
Do you think he has a family?
Everyone has a family, Alejandra, my father said. It just depends on whether that matters to them. I'd say it wasn't something Mr. Baker cared much about at all. Some men are like that. Real lone wolf types.
I imagined men in the mountains, wild with long hair and bloodied fangs for teeth.
I'm glad you're not like that, Papa.
My father chuckled. The creases around his eyes and mouth deepened. When we finished dinner, he kissed our hands and asked us to do the dishes.
If you need me, he said, I'll be out back.
I washed while Cora stacked and dried. Through the window above the sink, I watched my father and a short man silhouetted against the garage light. They were looking at a television, walking around it, crouching down, pulling the cord straight. My father handed him a stereo and something else that was in a smallish cardboard box. The short man carried the items to his pickup, and my father shut and locked the garage. I handed Cora a cup with an image of Tinkerbell, stuck, jamming her wide hips through a keyhole.
You know, he steals all that stuff, she said. From the dead old people. That's not true. Papa wouldn't do that.
Cora took the last dish from me. I turned off the faucet and watched my father take a handful of cash from the man.
You don't know what anyone would or wouldn't do, Cora said. You're just a baby. That's Mr. Baker's TV. I guarantee it.
Within a couple weeks, spring had shifted into the beginnings of summer. School had finally let out, and Cora and I spent more time at Julian Plaza than ever. On a Monday in early June, my father's shift ended an hour early, and he drove us to Miss Cynthia's in his small maroon pickup. He put on a Steely Dan CD as we rode along Park Avenue, the windows down, a warm breeze riding through our hair. The music was like a soundtrack to our neighborhood. Little old ladies with white parasols, homeless men with spotted dogs, policemen on black bicycles and green vests, and all the other cars and trucks with headlights and grills like shining, optimistic faces. My father was singing Dirty Work when he pulled over outside of a big black Victorian house. He opened the truck's door and stepped onto the sidewalk, crossing a patch of grass until he stood beside a lilac bush. He retrieved his work knife from his back pocket, cutting off a branch.
Smell those, babies, he said, as he stepped back inside the truck. Your mama's favorite.
Isn't that stealing?
Cora asked coolly from the front seat.
Nah, they went over the sidewalk. It's a public service.
I laughed from the middle seat, and my father winked before setting the flowers in my lap. In bed, tiny beneath thick quilts, my mother smiled as we approached her side. My father presented his lilacs, arms out, as if he carried an exotic purple bird.
Pretty,
she said, and my father placed the flowers on the mantel across the room, their lightness and sweet smell overpowering the stale stench of sickness. My mother uncoiled her palms, laying her hands open across the bed as if she were absorbing our visit through her skin. We each took a turn with greetings and kisses. We rubbed her forehead, kissed her cheeks. She had recently lost so much weight that bones I never knew existed rose from her face, carving deep shadows around her eyes. Somehow, despite her body shrinking away, that afternoon it felt calm and restful in her room, as if the four of us were napping together in some enormous white bed. After a long while, Miss Cynthia stepped through the back door, her rooster apron sashaying like gutter leaves caught in the wind. Cora and I moved to the window, where we sat on the long wooden bench.
She's due to be shifted,
Miss Cynthia said, and my father nodded. Cora and I watched as they considered my mother's body like a puzzle. With my father's help, Miss Cynthia maneuvered my mother onto her left side, propping pillows beneath her neck and arms, positioning her in a way that I imagined mermaids rested if they ever found themselves beached.
She isn't a high risk for bed sores, Miss Cynthia said to my father. But you can never be too careful.
I had no idea what bed sores were, but I pictured a bed with sharp teeth ready to puncture my mother's legs and hips, ripping full chunks from her body. Once my mother was comfortable in her new position, Cora stood from the wooden bench and approached my mother with a small jar of Carmex from the side table. She dipped her pinky inside and then ran her finger over our mother's lips.
You're chapped, Mama.
My big helper, Cora,
she said, smacking her lips together and kissing the air. That night, I dreamed of my mother before she was sick. I was 5 years old, and we were visiting my grandfather far away in a town called Sewarita, where my mother had grown up. The land was a wide valley surrounded by the bluest mountains with the whitest peaks. Cora and I were playing tag in the big field behind Grandpa Marcelo's tiny adobe home. The grown-ups watched from the lighted wooden porch. They were speaking softly and sipping beers, listening to Spanish songs on the radio, a strumming, sad guitar. Cora and I would turn back and wave to them before chasing each other again, twirling and giggling in all directions. We had made it to the edge of the property, a place where a barbed wire fence split the land in two. I was close to tagging Cora's arm, but she lunged to the side, her long black braid slithering through the air. That's when I stopped running and gasped at the sight of a baby deer very still in the tall grass, two bright lights for eyes.
"Are you all alone?"
I whispered.
"Where is your mama?"
Cora stopped running too, and she backtracked to stand beside me.
"Maybe she was abandoned,"
she suggested. Cora smirked, and I felt the edges of my mouth mirror hers. Like blackbirds silently shifting direction in mid-flight, in that moment we understood one another without words. We wanted to take that baby deer home with us, where it would sleep beneath our beds, graze throughout our yard, drink water from our tub. Our new sister, the animal. But we heard our mother then. She was sprinting in our direction, her hands gripping the bottom of her long yellow sundress as she shouted, "No, baby girls!" She looked taller and stronger than usual as she ran in strappy leather sandals. Even in twilight, I could see her face, determined and poised. She looked like fire burning her way across the valley. By the time my mother had reached Cora and me, the baby deer had bolted to the other side of the barbed wire fence.
"Her mama is only out gathering food," my mother said between heavy breaths. "I promise you, she'll come back."
The next morning, I found Cora on top of the garage. She was like a Christmas decoration in the middle of summer. Her hair was a black mess, unbrushed and unbraided. She paced in our mother's Betty Boop t-shirt, which fell past her knees. When I stepped into the backyard, she paused and lifted her arm as though blocking a bright light.
"What up, alley cat? Can I come up?"
Cora pretended to yawn.
"Walk over by the fence. I'll help you."
I could see our entire neighborhood. The mountains, my elementary school, Julian Plaza with its middle floors surrounded by a ring of green treetops. The clouds sagged over the city like a blanket of air. Cora stood beside me, her hand resting on her hip, her eyes scanning the city. She pointed toward Colfax Avenue with its hurried traffic, lined by motels and bars.
"Mama's over there," she said, "behind the Burger King." "It doesn't even look that far," I said.
"I know," Cora said.
"She should be home with us." "Mama can't live with us," I said. "Who would take care of her?"
"I can. I'm probably much better at it than Miss Cynthia. What does she know anyway?" I thought about how before my mother left, from the living room window, Cora and I watched her collapse in the front yard as she went to get the mail. We both waited a moment, as if she'd stand up and brush herself off. When she didn't, we ran outside without our shoes and coats. We tried to lift her and bring her inside, and when that didn't work, we attempted to drag her thin body into the house. We lived on a block where lawnmowers and bikes were stolen from garages in broad daylight, but no one walked by to help us. I cried and lay next to her, while Cora ran inside and called our father from the kitchen. He drove home from Julian Plaza in record time. "I think Miss Cynthia's a good lady," I said. "She does Mama's hair and gives her nice blankets."
"Look, she only takes care of Mama because she's getting paid. She doesn't care about her. She cares about money."
Cora then slinked with one slender leg and then the other onto the wooden fence.
"Come on, alley cat. We need to get ready."
"You's walked all the way here?" Miss Cynthia asked, scooting a plate of sugar cookies over her kitchen table in our direction.
Her glasses were coated in dust.
two wiry black hairs poked out above her top lip, and she had a toddler I hadn't seen before in her lap, a little girl gnawing her entire hand, her forearm covered in drool. Miss Cynthia wiped the baby's mouth with her rooster apron.
Yeah, Cora said, refusing a cookie. It isn't far.
And you didn't get lost? I mean, you and the baby girl just found your way on your own?
We've been coming here for months. We know the way.
Miss Cynthia broke a cookie against the table and offered some to the baby.
Smart girl. I'm not sure if you're more like your mama or papa.
She's like both, I said, biting into my cookie.
We both are like both. Miss Cynthia smiled. Some teeth were brown with black gaps. She held her grin for too long and rose from the table, setting the toddler on the linoleum floor. The tot stood wobbly for a moment before crawling to the plastic rocking horse in the hallway. Miss Cynthia stood next to the telephone and adjusted a crucifix with baby Jesus nailed to the cross. He bled pink around his crown of thorns.
Listen, girls, your mama isn't well today. She's been having an especially rough morning. Her sickness is in her bones now. It's everywhere.
Cora said she understood.
Don't you want to wait for your papa? He brings you over almost every day anyway. That way you can be with them both.
No, Cora said. We'd like to see our mother right now. Thank you.
Miss Cynthia lifted the plate of sugar cookies from the table, setting them down again on a countertop.
If you insist, your mother is in the back room, in bed.
Cora and I had been around sick and dying people our entire lives. People, we learned, weren't permanent, and neither were their illnesses. When I was 6 years old and Cora was 8, our mother regularly visited a woman named Billy at Julian Plaza, who had long droopy ears and one leg. Cora told me the leg was chopped off because of a disease that made your limbs die before the rest of you did. Once, while we watched The Price is Right with Billy, Cora looked away from the spinning wheel and said,
If doctors wanted to take my leg, I'd try to get it run over by a train or a bus.
My mother shrieked and apologized for Cora. Billy died later that year, but I never forgot how her apartment smelled, like dirt inches below a garden surface, where roots twirl into one another. That day at Miss Cynthia's, I sniffed the air and realized my mother's room smelled exactly like that. The blinds were closed and the room was dim. My mother lay in her rented hospital bed beneath many colorful quilts. Wisps of hair curled around her forehead like tiny black worms. Her entire face seemed deflated, drained of blood. Cora twisted open the blinds. A plane of white light spread into the room, and my mother's eyelids fluttered. I sat beside her, stroking her forehead. She felt cool and damp, the way I imagine a snail feels inside its shell.
Hi, Mama,
I whispered close enough for my lips to touch her ear. She blinked and looked at me with eyes so black they resembled the spaces between stars.
I was supposed to get you from school.
It's summertime, Cora said, pushing the wheelchair to our mother's bed. She bent down, unfolding the footrests and adjusting the handles.
We told you last time, Mama. School's been out for a while.
My mother reached for Cora's face. Her nails had been painted a bright strawberry red by Miss Cynthia. They were short, studded berries that moved along Cora's head, petting her like an animal. My mother winced.
It's hard to keep track of the weather,
she said, and rolled onto her side. She closed her eyes, letting out a long, guttural moan. Cora said,
You shouldn't be here. You've only gotten sicker. I knew it would make you worse. No one listens to me.
My mother bit the edge of her pillow, her teeth sinking into the case. She spoke in murmurs and groans.
We can't understand you, Cora said.
Babies?
She breathed.
Can you get...
She cried out.
Miss Cynthia?
Cora looked as though she'd been struck. She shook her head and reached for the bed's remote. I asked her not to and tugged on her arm. She pushed me off and raised the mattress until our mother sat upright, the quilts falling to her waist. It looked as though her limbs had evaporated. I pressed her sleeve, expecting only air. She looked confused and small, like a feverish child homesick from school. I scooted off the bed, and I stared at the hump of her feet, shivering and slight beneath the quilts. I placed my hand over her right foot.
She's not feeling good, I told Cora.
That's why she's leaving, Cora said.
That's why we're taking her.
Cora hunched over and slipped her hands beneath our mother's side. With a jerk of her neck, she gestured for me to do the same.
I don't know, I said. She hurts.
It'll be easy. Remember when Papa did it? He lifted her like a baby.
Fine,
I said, doing what Cora asked, positioning myself against my mother's hip. Cora nodded.
All right, Alley Cat. One, two, three, lift.
My mother's body rose from the mattress. Her pelvis poked my palms, and her nightgown pulled straight behind her. We had her. She was in our hands, rising to the roof like smoke. We could carry her. It was possible. She'd glide home in her wheelchair, beautiful and thin, elegant in the sunlight. But my mother opened her eyes, and I saw how far we'd really gone. Nowhere at all. With a frightened jolt, she wailed and squirmed. Cora lost her grip first, placing my mother's dead weight on me until we both flopped against the bed, the metal handrail, the plastic remote. I let go and backed away as my mother cried out over and over. The door opened then, and Miss Cynthia stepped into the room. She walked behind the wheelchair with her rooster apron hanging loosely over her legs. She stared at us, her glasses white with light, and her mouth a gaping black hole.
What in God's name?
When Miss Cynthia told our father what we had done, he drove us home in silence, his disappointment thick as he leaned into turns and idled at red lights. The street was like a horse's long back, dark with specks of light. I went to bed that night listening to the sounds of Cora crying quietly on the other side of the wall. I tried reading more about the horse named Marcus, but everything he did seemed suited for a cartoon, something enjoyable, something fake. Cora tapped her wall a couple times, code for me to enter her room, and I stepped through the darkness and lay down in her twin bed. Her long hair was wetly matted against her Little Mermaid pillowcase. She pulled me close to her and said,
"Don't worry. We'll figure out another way to get her. I promise."
But Cora didn't have to find a new way to bring our mother home, because not long after, while the three of us were at Julian Plaza, my father on his knees pulling white hairs from drains, and Cora and me watching Nickelodeon in the rec room, our garage was robbed, the thieves taking everything my father sold to pay Miss Cynthia. That evening, my father pulled into the back driveway and sat for a long while staring at the open garage door. He finally stepped out and inspected the busted lock. He crouched down, yanked blades of grass from the ground, and let them blow away in the wind, as if they'd point him in the direction of the thief. At dinner, my father sat very still at the kitchen table. He He breathed into a clenched fist. He kissed the tops of our heads and smoothed our hair. His work shirt was torn at the elbow, and his stubble inked over his chin and cheeks.
We're bringing Mama home in the next few days. It's going to be tough. I'll have to work most days, but I know my girls can take care of her while I'm away.
I'll stay with her every day, Cora said.
My father covered his face with both hands. He stood from the table and walked to the bathroom. We heard the sink running, and beneath the sounds of rushing water, a long, guttural sob. A few days later, a heat wave moved into the city. Sweaty children rushed the streets in ripped-up shorts and cotton tanks. Cora and I watched them from Julian Plaza's lobby, where we sat in black plastic chairs. Above them, the day moon was a sliver of a fingernail. Cora fanned herself with a Christian newsletter, dropped off earlier by a black woman in a blue skirt clear to the floor. The hanging chalkboard only announced an ice cream social and the birth of a grandchild named John Michael.
I'm bored, Cora said. Do you want to play outside?
I asked. Cora allowed her legs to dangle back and forth to the beat of the ticking clock.
Hydrant water is dirty.
She slid further down in her chair, surprising me when she asked,
What else do you want to do, Alley Cat?
I thought about the rec room, the Chinese checkers, the TV. We could eat packets of coffee creamer, pour sugar in rows for ants, toss rocks into the dumpsters. None of it seemed worthwhile.
Want a race?
Cora dropped the Christian newsletter to the floor. She sat up and smiled.
We'll run each floor until we get to the top.
She paused before saying,
On your mark, get set, go,
I yelled. We started down the hallway, and I pretended the green carpets were grass while the ceiling lights were rays of sunlight. After zigzagging up to the next floor and the floor after that, we came to a level with nearly all apartment doors open. It was swampy hot. Tenants sat in their crammed one-bedroom apartments, their metal fans blowing with wisps of paper. I saw an orange couch. I saw macrame wall art. I saw a lone silver head leaning into a bowl of soup. Some watched black and white movies, the volume at full blast. Maidens in white tied to railroad tracks. Cowboy heroes shot dead. As we raced through every floor, zigzagging through Julian Plaza's ancient insides, I remembered a time when I was very little and my mother wasn't sick. It was summer, and she wore a brown print dress and tall, loud sandals with gardenia perfume and olive oil in her hair. She carried me on her slender hip while Cora walked beside us. We were visiting old people to give them pies, apple and rhubarb, strawberry and pecan. The pies weren't for everyone, just those without family, the people who needed them most. My mother knocked, and when each door opened, the people of Julian Plaza beamed with happiness, as if they'd never seen a young woman so lovely in all their long lives.
Galapago. Read for you by Marisol Ramirez. The day before Perla Ortiz killed a man, she had lunch at home with her granddaughter Alana. They sat together at the aluminum table in the small canary yellow kitchen and ate turkey wraps with a wet kale salad. Alana had stopped by on her lunch break. She worked downtown in a glass high-rise for a marketing firm specializing in oil and gas and was dressed plainly in a brown shift dress, her lightened hair pulled high in a ponytail. Perla watched Judy Garland sing in black and white on the television above the refrigerator and methodically chewed kale her dentures couldn't easily break down. She preferred her usual, flour tortillas with beans and rice, but she had learned to humor her granddaughter, who, despite her prickliness, was good-hearted in her own way. We'll look at a few